Welcome to Least of These, where I cover the cases that need it most, because every life matters and everyone deserves justice. I'm your host, Leah D., and today I'll be covering the case of Jacqueline Bonds in Manhattan, New York. Let's get right to it. In 1988, through a federal law passed by Congress titled the Protection of Children from Sexual Predator Act of 1988, the United States government tried to formalize the definition of a serial killer. You see, over the years, several definitions of serial murder were used by law enforcement, mental health professionals, and academics, all of which had slight variations, like a cooling-off period, which was a requirement in some and not in others, or the number of victims and the rate at which the murders were committed. It led to confusion as to what cases federal resources could be brought in to assist state and local law enforcement officials. So the federal government sought to nail down a definition. And in Title 18, Chapter 51, Section 1111 of the United States Code, the term serial killings means a series of three or more killings, not less than one of which was committed within the United States, having common characteristics such as to suggest the reasonable possibility that the crimes were committed by the same actor or actors. While that definition is helpful when it comes to establishing criteria as to when the FBI can assist local law enforcement in their investigations of serial homicide cases, it does nothing to attempt to define the psychology of these predators, or to recognize the patterns in killings or victimology that most serial killers display, which of course is instrumental in identifying and capturing this particular type of killer. According to an article by Dr. Scott Bond published in Psychology Today in 2005 at a symposium on serial homicide, the FBI reduced the minimum number of victims from 3 to 2 in its own definition of serial murder. At the same time, the FBI also eliminated the cooling-off period, or the time a serial killer is inactive before the urge to kill builds up and they strike again. This cooling-off period was eliminated, the FBI determining that that requirement was not useful for the purposes of a criminal investigation. While the FBI determined that requirement wasn't useful for their purposes, from a psychological perspective, that cooling-off period is a key characteristic used to distinguish serial killers from all other types of murderers. Dr. Bond went on to say that this period is vital to the definition of serial murder and understanding the pathological needs and criminal psychology of the perpetrator. The cooling-off period is important because it constitutes a timeout for murder. And during the cooling-off period between murders, a serial killer typically disappears from the public eye and resumes their normal routine in life. This life may appear completely normal to the rest of the world, typical, uneventful, and even routine. But what if a serial killer was forced into this cooling-off period? Forced because they were unable to fulfill their fantasies without an opportunity to kill? What if this killer didn't have access to a victim because they were behind bars? What if law enforcement caught this killer likely the first time they had lashed out and taken a life? Caught, convicted, and sentenced to life in prison, where that should be the end of the story. We'd never really know this murderer was in fact a serial killer, because they'd serve out their sentence, die behind bars, be buried in a potter's field, and forgotten. I mean, that should be where the story ends. But what if that serial killer, despite a life sentence, was paroled, released back into society, and free to kill again? Today's case should be a standalone episode, and in a way it is. Today I'll be telling you the story of Jacqueline Bonds, a story that takes us all the way back to Manhattan in the spring of 1963. But that is only the beginning of this story. Okay, fellow true crime fans, let me ask you this. If a body turns up with a mysterious clue left beside it, are you calling the police or immediately starting a conspiracy board in your living room? Or both? That's the decision crime reporter Nikki Gillette faces in best-selling author Lisa Jackson's slow burn thriller, Not What It Seems. What starts as an apparent accident in Georgia's Lowcountry quickly spirals into something much darker. One victim becomes two. Two become more, and beside every body is the same unsettling clue, a polished stone engraved with a number and a strange symbol. Nikki can't let it go, and honestly, neither would we. And I felt the same way when I picked up this book. I couldn't put it down. There were so many twists, turns, and just when I thought I got it all figured out, I was thrown for another loop. It was a perfect summer read. You feel like you're right alongside Nikki as she follows the trail through Savannah's historic streets and eerie marshes, uncovering secrets, suspects, and a killer who just might be closer than anyone realizes. If you enjoy reading authors like Paula Hawkins, Karen Slaughter, and Riley Sager, you'll love this book. Atmospheric, creepy, and packed with the kind of clues you'll be obsessing over between chapters, Not What It Seems is the latest thriller from number one New York Times bestselling author Lisa Jackson. Pick up Not What It Seems wherever books are sold. '63 was one of those years where a lot of history was made in just 12 short months, both good and bad. It was the peak of the civil rights movement. Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. delivered his iconic I Have a Dream speech at the Lincoln Memorial. The war in Vietnam was raging. President John F. Kennedy was assassinated in Dallas. Andy Warhol became a thing. The Beverly Hillbillies were all the rage. Sugar Ray Robinson was in the ring, and Gregory Peck received an Oscar for To Kill a Mockingbird. It would go down in history as a year of revolution, transformation, scandal, and tragedy. The evening of April 18, 1963, 21-year-old Jacqueline Bonds was at her Manhattan apartment on 8th Avenue. According to NY Amsterdam News, Jacqueline was in her home entertaining a guest. While exact details are a little hard to come by, it appears Jacqueline was there with a friend. Maybe the two were talking over dinner or coffee, discussing the news of the day. There was plenty to talk about. Or maybe they were talking about the events happening a little closer to home. Either way, Jacqueline was in her apartment when there was a knock at the door. She opened the door to find 24-year-old Harvey Marcelin standing on the other side. Harvey asked her to step out into the hallway because whatever he wanted to discuss, he certainly didn't want to discuss it in front of her guest. Jacqueline stepped out into the hallway, and moments later, a shot rang out. According to court records, Harvey Marcelin raised his .32-caliber revolver and shot Jacqueline right there in the hallway. Jacqueline ran back into her apartment, retreating to her bedroom, but Harvey Marcelin followed and shot her again. She stumbled out of the bedroom and into her living room, where he shot her a third and final time. 21-year-old Jacqueline Bonds collapsed and died right there on her living room floor. Harvey Marcelin fled the scene. But it didn't take investigators long to catch up to him. He had shot Jacqueline right there in the hallway of her Manhattan apartment in front of multiple witnesses, to include, of course, the guest that was over at Jacqueline's house. Several hours after the murders, police arrested Marcelin at his apartment off Park Place in Brooklyn. When investigators arrived, Harvey was reportedly sound asleep. He was taken into custody and directly to the jail. He denied killing Jacqueline, but was charged with murder. It was clear immediately who had murdered Jacqueline Bonds, but why? On the surface, it didn't appear Jacqueline Bonds and Harvey Marcelin were even remotely cut from the same cloth. So what was their connection? Jacqueline was a bright, beautiful 21-year-old stenographer for the Board of Education. And Harvey, well, he was a married man and a violent criminal. Not the kind of person you'd think someone like Jacqueline would associate with. But it's very likely Jacqueline Bonds had no idea what she was getting herself into when she first met Harvey. However, she was quickly figuring it out and trying desperately to get away from him. Let's take it all the way back to the beginning. According to the New York Post, Harvey Marsland was born in Manhattan in 1938. His mother worked as a seamstress and his father as a shipping clerk, but tragically, his father died when Harvey was just 10 years old. Harvey Marsland was an only child raised by his mother in Washington Heights. His mom did everything she could for him. He would later state to the New York Post, "They spoiled me. My mother was soft-spoken and tried to raise me. I was just cantankerous. I was an only child." Despite the best efforts of his mother, by the time Harvey was just 14 years old, he was already extremely violent. Court records showed that he was accused of rape at the age of 14. And shortly after that, he had been examined by a psychiatrist after having been involved in, quote, truancy, theft, heterosexual, and homosexual activity, and cross-dressing. Marsland would later claim to the New York Post that he had acted out due to childhood trauma. He claimed that he had been sexually abused, whipped by nuns, and forced to eat bad food at a Catholic daycare center in Harlem. Now, I'm not saying any of this is true or not true. I'll leave that up to you to decide. But I will say that none of what Marsland claimed is backed up by any evidence that I could find. But that is his story. About the alleged abuse, he stated, "My mother had to literally drag me there. I'd be pleading, no, no, no. One time I ran away, but they chased me down the street and caught me. They treated me bad, very bad. So I think I flipped there." According to court records, as a teenager, Marsland already showed a propensity for violence against women. As an adult, Harvey Marsland was married to a woman named Florence Jackson, but he lived with his mother. He worked operating copy machines, earning $75 a week, which wasn't too shabby in 1960 dollars and considered solid middle-class income. Which sounds absolutely crazy today, right? Anyhow, so Marsland was married but living with his mom, working and earning a decent wage, but also in and out of psychiatric care. The New York Times reported that Marsland drank often and used cocaine. He was arrested in 1957 for felony assault. It's unclear exactly when or how Jacqueline Bonds crossed paths with Harvey Marsland, but at some point she did, and the two began dating. It's also likely Jacqueline had no idea Harvey was married and would have never suspected he was since he lived at home with his mother. There were troubles early on in their relationship. The New York Times reported that Marsland had assaulted Jacqueline on more than one occasion. And then, according to parole records, in early 1963, Marsland was accused of raping another woman, 24-year-old Clementine Benefield. And that's when it appears Jacqueline Bonds really tried to cut things off with Marsland. But when she told him that she wasn't going to be seeing him anymore, he was angry. He pointed his finger at her and said, "I'll get you." This was reportedly 6 weeks before the murder, and it all happened right in front of Jacqueline's mom. On April 5, 1963, Harvey Marsland was indicted by a grand jury in Brooklyn for attempted first-degree rape, second-degree assault, and second-degree burglary. But Harvey Marsland had a plan to beat those charges. He told the court that Jacqueline Bonds was his alibi. He claimed he had been with her that night. At Harvey Marsland's request, Jacqueline was subpoenaed to testify before the grand jury. That testimony was supposed to take place on April 18, 1963, but Jacqueline Bonds didn't show up in court. She never took the stand or told anyone that Marsland was with her that night. According to NY Amsterdam News, later that evening after the court hearing, Harvey Marsland called Jacqueline Bonds and asked her out on a date. Jacqueline refused and ultimately hung up the phone. But moments later, Harvey Marsland was at her door with that .32 revolver. Jacqueline Bonds was murdered, shot 3 times at point-blank range, hours after she failed to provide Harvey Marsland with an alibi in a rape case. Those rape charges were ultimately dropped, likely because Marsland was now facing murder charges. We'll be right back. Harvey Marcellin pled not guilty to murder. According to court records, Marcellin basically refused to cooperate or even communicate with his defense counsel. All he would ever say is that he, quote, didn't do it. He refused to cooperate during the 4.5-month pretrial phase or during the 2-month period of both phases of trial. And Harvey Marcellin's defense team really needed him to cooperate. After all, back in the 1960s, New York was still a death penalty state, and Marcellin's life was on the line. His court-appointed attorneys did all they could to try and get Marcellin to assist in his own defense. They had his mother and a neighbor who was close to the family meet with him and beg him to open up and speak to his counsel. But Harvey flat-out refused. At request of his counsel, the court ordered 2 separate psychiatric exams. According to court records, in August of 1963, he was committed to Bellevue Psychiatric for an exam to determine if he was competent to stand trial. He remained at Bellevue for 6 weeks. 3 Bellevue psychiatrists concluded he was, quote, without psychosis, although he was possessed of schizoid personality with sociopathic features. But all 3 believed he was more than competent to stand trial. After his stint at Bellevue, Marcellin still refused to cooperate. So in October of 1963, again at the request of his counsel, he was evaluated by a different psychiatrist who wrote in his report, quote, petitioner is not incapable of making his defense should he choose to communicate with those responsible for it. And with that, the case made its way to trial. For the prosecution, it was a slam dunk. According to court records, there were 6 to 7 eyewitnesses that watched as Harvey Marcellin shot and killed Jacqueline Bonds. It came as no surprise that he was convicted of first-degree murder. But when it came to sentencing, the jury couldn't decide between life and death, so the judge stepped in and ordered a sentence of life in prison. He was eventually shipped off to the infamous Attica State Prison. Though Harvey Marcellin had repeatedly told his defense that he quote-unquote didn't do it, decades after the murders he would sit down and admit to a reporter at the New York Post that he had killed Jacqueline Bonds, not because of rejection or her refusal to provide him with an alibi, but because of jealousy. He stated, "She was very popular, and I had images of her just being nice to somebody else. Yeah, sexually, you know. She was beautiful. I didn't want anyone else to have her." Well, I'll be damned if that ain't enough to gag a maggot. Never mind the fact that at the time of the murder, this man had a whole ass wife. Anyhow, as the years passed, Marcellin fought hard to gain his freedom, and also bitched in the press anytime he could. In 1969, the Times Union reported that the appellate division of the U.S. New York State Supreme Court passed a new law allowing inmates to take brutality claims against prison officials to state courts. According to the outlet, the decision was issued in Harvey Marcellin's case after he claimed he was denied access to the prison chaplain, forced to stand naked for long periods of time, and denied a toothbrush and comb. In November of 1971, Marcellin was back at it again. The reporter Dispatch published an article about 462 Attica inmates who had been transferred to Great Meadow Correctional Facility after the infamous riots at Attica Prison. During the riots, over 1,200 inmates took control of the prison to protest overcrowding, reportedly brutal living conditions, and rampant racism. 42 staff members were taken hostage. Prisoners drafted a list of 28 demands, mostly focused on basic civil and human rights. To make a really long story short, ultimately negotiations failed, and the governor of New York ordered state troopers, corrections officers, and the National Guard to storm the prison by force. In less than 15 minutes, 33 inmates and 10 hostages were killed, the hostages taken out by police gunfire. Of course, during the mayhem, sections of the prison had been destroyed. According to reports, the plan was to transfer those 462 inmates so that the section of the prison that had been destroyed could be rebuilt, and it just so happened that Great Meadow had a ton of open cells after a drug rehabilitation pilot project had been scrapped. The outlet spoke to several inmates, one of them being Harvey Marcellin, who was now 33 years old. About his short time at Great Meadow, Marcelin had plenty of complaints. He stated, "I think they are intentionally provoking us here to see how far the inmates will go. They're a bunch of little things mostly, but things designed to drive us crazy. They have been banging on the bars with their sticks all through the night, intentionally slamming the steel in grates at night and jeering at us. Attica was better than this place. It's really funny. You don't miss something until it's gone. Sifting the two evils, I would prefer to be back in Attica." And at some point, it appears Marcelin got his wish. But of course, he didn't stop there. The New York Post reported that Marcelin acted as his own lawyer in a number of lawsuits, asking for new trials, complaining that one all-female parole board was sexist in denying his release, and trying to get in on a class-action lawsuit because he was at Attica during the riots. Marcelin also appealed his conviction in both state and federal courts and made claims of ineffective counsel as one of his many grounds for appeal. One of the main points Marcelin brought up was the fact that a year prior to the murders, he had been voluntarily admitted to Bellevue. It was April 9th of 1962. He was hospitalized for a week. According to court documents, the hospital records mentioned the phrases delusional grandiosity, suggestions of chronic schizophrenia, and paranoid reaction personality. Now, the records don't say these were his diagnoses, just that they were mentioned in the notes. Make of that what you will. The examining psychiatrist at the time found that with medication, Marcelin had done well, and he was discharged in the custody of his wife after being hospitalized for a week. Marcelin had never told the court or his defense team about this admission to Bellevue, and now Marcelin was trying to use it to prove that his counsel had been ineffective. But the court records tell no lies. As we talked about before, his defense had tried. He was the one who had been ineffective in assisting his defense team, and it wasn't because he was quote-unquote crazy. He just refused to participate. I'm not going to waste your time on all his other grounds for appeal because they were equally as stupid and ultimately denied. The appeals court found he was not denied his constitutional right to effective assistance of counsel, writing in part, "Petitioner's counsel were faced with the almost impossible assignment of attempting to defend a client who refused to talk to them and against whom the prosecution's first-degree murder case was overwhelming. For after all, who would be in a better position than petitioner himself to know of his voluntary admission to Bellevue a year before the crime for which counsel had been assigned to defend him? Petitioner appears to have been an individual with a mind of his own, as borne out by his adamant insistence upon not taking the witness stand and not pleading to a lesser offense, thus rejecting his counsel's advice in both respects. And yet, despite repeated requests by counsel to petitioner and members of his family for information that would be helpful to his defense, they said nothing about his 1962 Bellevue admission, and indeed at no time indicated to counsel the slightest hint of any prior psychiatric history of the petitioner. It was upon the initiative of counsel themselves that the court ordered two separate psychiatric examinations of petitioner in August and October of 1963. And with that, Marcelin's conviction was affirmed with only one dissenting opinion. Since he wasn't going to get out on an appeal, Marcelin fought repeatedly to get himself in front of the parole board. At one hearing, members of the parole board expressed concern that even while in prison, Marcelin had apparently sent inappropriate letters to Candy Striper Hospital volunteers. In case you didn't know, back in the day, young teenage and youth volunteers working in the hospitals were referred to as Candy Stripers, a reference to the red and white striped uniforms they typically wore. These were teenagers he was sending inappropriate letters to. When confronted with how inappropriate this was by one of the board members, Marcelin responded, "That is all in the past, and when I became aware that this pattern was creating, I cut it loose." About the murders, ABC 7 New York reported that Marcelin told the three-panel parole board, quote, "It will never happen again." And with that, they let him out. Harvey Marcelin, who was sentenced to life in prison, was released on lifetime parole in May of 1984. He said that it would never happen again, but it did. It did happen again. Not long after Marceline Harvey was set free, another young woman would be dead. But that's a story for next week. This has got to be one of the most unbelievable cases we've covered on this podcast to date. So make sure you tune in next week. You're not going to want to miss it. Before we go, I just got to say there wasn't much I could find about Jacqueline Bonds and who she was. There were only a few articles published back when the murder occurred, maybe three if I remember correctly. Unfortunately, all I can tell you is that Jacqueline Denise Jackie Bonds was born on November 8, 1941. In every article I did read, she was described as strikingly beautiful. She was laid to rest at Hemingway Cemetery in Horry County, South Carolina. At just 21 years old, her life was just beginning. Had it not been for Harvey Marceline, Jacqueline would be 85 years old today. And that, my friends, is all I've got for this week. Be sure to join me next Thursday, same time, same place. In the meantime, you can find me on Instagram at least_of_these or my Facebook at Least of These Podcast. And if you're sick of ad interruptions, I've got good news for you. You can get all your episodes ad-free, just the way you like them, for just $2 a month. And as a member of Patreon, you'll be the first to be notified when new tiers will launch with exclusive episodes and a few bonus surprises. Head on over to patreon.com/leastofthese to support the show today. Thank you for listening. Thank you for caring. If you know something, say something. And until next time, be good to each other. This is going to be a short and sweet one. There is so much I want to say, but we'll have to get to it later because, like I said, this is only the tip of the iceberg. There is so much more to this story, and if I start talking, there is no chance I'll shut up. But what I will say, and I've said this before, but life in prison needs to mean life in prison. Like, you're coming out in a body bag. Because if that's not what it means, then why the hell is it called life in prison? Life isn't 20 years. Life isn't 30 years. Life is life, and we should say what we mean and mean what we say. You get life, your ass dies in jail. That's it. That's the hot take. And I really don't even think it's much of a hot take. I know there's probably a whole lot of people that agree. I'm sure there's at least one that doesn't, because there's one in every crowd. But as brazen as this crime was, ain't no way he should have ever been paroled. He murdered Jacqueline in front of multiple people while facing charges for raping another woman. And there's nothing that will convince me that part of the reason he did what he did was because he was pissed off that Jacqueline would be his alibi. He was mad that she didn't want to be with him anymore, and her not showing up in that courtroom that day for him probably sent him right over the edge. Not only could he not have her, she wasn't even going to stick up for him and help keep him out of prison after he allegedly raped Clementine. And I'm only saying allegedly here because I have to. In my opinion, he probably raped her. I mean, it certainly tracks. Allegedly. It tracks allegedly. And as you'll see, this dude is a perpetual victim. Like, he's always got a problem. The world has always done him wrong. He's a crybaby who lashes out when he doesn't get his way. And he's always bitching. And I do just want to point out, because his mental health already has and will come up again, he's incredibly intelligent and definitely says and does whatever he thinks people want to hear or what will help him get out of trouble. I'm sure his mental health wasn't like stellar or anything. I mean, after all, he's a murderer. Usually murderers aren't well-rounded individuals. But he's more crazy like a fox than legitimately quote-unquote crazy, insane, whatever you want to call it. Anyhow, I said I was going to keep this short and sweet. Y'all know I love you more than my luggage, and I can't wait to talk at you next week. But until then, bye-bye-bye!